Carl Stewart is an investment advisor representative of Carl Stewart Investment Advisor Incorporated. Call or text Carl now at 512-836-0590. Now, here's Carl.
Good afternoon, and welcome to Money Talk. I'm Carl Stewart, and you're listening to News Radio KLBJ. Thanks for listening. We're now in our 30th year here together on Money Talk. Money Talk is a broadcast about the world of financial and investment planning, where you always determine our agenda by calling or texting 512-836-0590. You may listen online right now at newsradioklbj.com or go there at your convenience and download podcasts of previous shows. Also, you can do that at SoundCloud, a free app. And this Thursday after the news at 6 p.m., we will rebroadcast today's show. It's always a wonderful idea to call or text at the beginning of the hour. Give me the best opportunity to do my best to answer your question. And when you stump the chump, if you call earlier in the hour, we frequently have really smart, educated listeners who do know the answer, particularly if it's about Social Security. So all the lines are open. We don't have any former texts that I haven't answered, so it's a great time to call or text 512-836-0590. So it's been really an interesting year as it regards the bond market and specifically the outlook for short-term interest rates. At the beginning of the year, the financial press said that the bets in the futures market were that the Federal Reserve would reduce interest rates this year six or possibly even seven times. And if you follow these things, you know, as of today, April 20th, 2024, there's been no decline in interest rates. And the bond market has struggled after having a terrific fourth quarter, where all of the return for bonds in 2023 occurred in that fourth quarter. The bond market's off slightly year to date. If you look at the AGG, which is the exchange-traded fund that follows the Bloomberg Ag, which is kind of the S&P 500 of the bond market, its return year to date through yesterday is minus 3.04%. And I get a daily, what's called a daily spark from the lead economist, at Apollo, which is a large, large asset management firm. And this gentleman named Torsten Slok said early in the year that the data showed him that there would not be six or seven rate cuts and that there might not even be any rate cuts. And I would say, based on listening and reading, that I'm not sure that he represents at all the consensus among economists, but there are certainly some strong indicators that he may be right or that we may have one or two rate cuts. And I looked at these numbers that he recently sent out. It says rates higher for longer than normal. It normally takes 8 months from the last Fed hike until the central bank starts cutting. But during this cycle, the Federal Reserve has kept interest rates constant for 10 months since the last hike in July of 2023. And with easy financial conditions still giving a significant boost to inflation and growth in the economy over the coming quarters, the risks are rising that we could see a Fed cycle, meaning interest rate cycle, that is very different, with the Fed keeping rates higher for much longer than we usually see. And he includes a bar chart going back to 1968 in periods of the Fed raising interest rates. And after they raised them to whatever the high was at that moment, then how long they kept it that way. And it's interesting because there are periods of time when the Fed has kept rates high for a long period of time. In 1969 to 1970, they kept them at that late, at the whatever rate they raised it to, for 18 months. And then again in 1997 and 1998, another 18-month period where when they stopped raising rates, they didn't begin to lower them. In 2006 and 2007, they held rates at that higher level for 15 months. And as I said earlier, this right now, since July of last year, they're higher for 10 months. So what does this mean? Does it mean that it's a good time to stay in cash because you can get over 5%? And the answer is it depends. I've always said, if you're a longtime listener, you know I've said this, cash, in my view, is not an investment because there's no total return potential. And that by cash, I mean money market accounts and money market funds in shorter term, 6 month, 12 month, 24 month CDs. And I'm not arguing against them, and I'm not suggesting they don't belong as part of your financial plan and investment portfolio, but based on history, over time, cash after taxes and after inflation has a negative return. So it seems to me that there are at least three buckets when we think about where we put our money. There's the money that we're going to pay the rent or buy the groceries or make the mortgage payment. And we're not really interested in a total return or making money. I think it was the famous humorist in the 20th century, Will Rogers, who said, I'm not interested in the return on my money. I'm interested in the return of my money. And that's the money that you probably have in a checking account. Then there's the next bucket, and that's for expenditures that you see coming up. Maybe you're going to be buying a new automobile in the next 18 months. Or maybe next summer, not this year, but the following year, you're going to take a nice long trip or a cruise. Or you know that you've got a child who's going to be starting college in the next 12 or 18 months, and you're going to have to be paying the tuition and room and board and all those kinds of things. So that's kind of the middle ground in my view. And money market funds, particularly right now, are very, very attractive because the Fed's raised interest rates and you can purchase a money market fund and get over 5%. Now, a money market fund is a mutual fund and it's not a deposit account. A money market account at your bank or your credit union is a deposit account and I believe is covered by FDIC insurance up to the $250,000 limit. A money market fund is a mutual fund, but it doesn't buy stocks and it doesn't buy longer-term bonds. It buys short-term instruments that mature in a year or less. And the object of a money market fund is whatever interest the money market fund gets from those debt instruments minus their operating expenses they pay to you. So in an environment like this where short-term rates are high, what they're investing in is high relative to where it's been the last few years, and you enjoy that. The price stays at $1 per share. That's called the net asset value. And you have daily liquidity. So if you own a money market fund at Charles Schwab or Fidelity or Morgan Stanley or Merrill Lynch, you're going to get whatever the underlying portfolio is minus those operating expenses. That's a great place for that middle money, if you will, that middle bucket for those known upcoming expenditures. You're listening to Money Talk on News Radio KLBJ. I'm Carl Stewart. We're going to take a break. A perfect time for you to call or text 512-836-0590. I'll be back.
You're listening to Money Talk with Carl Stewart on News Radio KLBJ, 590 AM and 99.7 FM. Enjoy the podcast on newsradioklbj.com. Now, here's Carl.
Welcome back to Money Talk. I'm Carl Stewart, and you're listening to News Radio KLBJ. Thanks for listening. We're here this afternoon until 5, and when you have a question, call or text 512-836-0590. Otherwise, it's going to be another one of those bloviation station days where I'm just going to keep talking until and unless you call or text 512-836-0590. So I said I think of capital or money in three buckets. The first bucket is the money that you're going to spend in the next few days, weeks, or months for your living expenses. The second bucket is known upcoming expenditures, whether that's you're going to buy an automobile or you're going to take a big trip or you've got a child starting college in 12 or 24 months, then you want to keep that money safe. And right now, a money market fund is extremely attractive because short-term interest rates are higher than they've been in many, many years. So there are really three kinds of what we call taxable money market funds. And the reason I use the word taxable is that if you are in a really high tax income and therefore a high tax bracket, there are such things as tax-exempt money market funds as well. Looks like we got a text, and if you're a regular listener, you know that I always stop bloviating when we get a text, so bear with me while I find it. Here it is. Hello, Carl. Since you're talking about money market funds, do you have any thoughts on municipal money market funds versus more traditional taxable ones? I do. I think that the way to do this is you take the taxable money market fund, and there are three general categories. There's what's called the treasuries, and they buy strictly U.S. Treasury debt, and therefore are considered to be the safest. The second are called, I beg your pardon, yeah, that's right. The second one are called government, and they buy U.S. Treasuries, but they can also buy government agencies like Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac debt. And then the third is called prime, and they can buy the same as the first two, but also they can buy corporate debt. And if there's a big spread, then you need to really look at that. But right now, you get over 5% in a government money market fund, and that's where I would go if I were going to go there. Now, having said that, a tax-exempt fund invests in things like tax anticipation notes where, let's say, Travis County wants to borrow $20 million for the next 60 days while they wait for property tax revenues to come in, and they go out and sell that. Is that anything wrong with that? Absolutely not. But you also have to be aware of what the tax brackets are, because then you look at what's called your marginal income tax bracket, which is the rate at which you're going to pay on the next dollar of taxable income. And then you can take a look at that tax-exempt money market fund return yield, and you can do the math to determine if it's more beneficial to be in the tax-exempt money market fund than it is to be in the taxable. The tax-exempt municipal bond market is known as being extremely safe, and that's because the bonds generally are for public purposes like schools and highways and things like that, which there's just an overriding interest in making sure that those entities can borrow money and therefore that they're going to pay it back. But if you're married filing jointly this year, then it looks to me like I may have the 2023 rates. I apologize, but they're similar. For you to be in the top tax bracket, which is the 37% bracket, and if you're married filing jointly, you have to have taxable income in excess of $693,000. To be in the 35% bracket, over $462,000. And that's if married filing jointly. If you're single, the top bracket, you have to be making more taxable income than $578,000. And if you're single or in the 35% bracket, more than $231,000. So you want to make sure that your yield on a tax exempt is better than taxable, because what I find is that many people who understand themselves to be in a high bracket can look at a tax-exempt money market fund and it still doesn't make sense for them, because the taxable money market fund, say the government fund like I was talking about, let's pretend it's 5%, and let's say you're in the 30% bracket because I can do the math, that's 1.5% of the 5% is going to go to taxes. You're getting a 3.5% net after-tax yield, so you've got to get more than 3.5% in your tax-exempt money market fund to justify purchasing it. Great question. You're listening to Money Talk on News Radio KLBJ. Call or text 512-836-0590. Brad, you're on the air. How may I help?
Hey, good afternoon, Carl. My brain's still trying to recover from those money market account those details.
Right.
Hey, you had something last week, I believe it was, and I don't remember if it was a stump to chump or something you answered directly. And I think somebody called in, and their spouse had died, and they jointly, they had a house, a primary residence.
Yes.
And I you were comparing the protection you got just by the capital gains on a primary residence versus what I thought you said was they could rebasis the price of the house when that joint owner passed away.
Yes.
And if that's what you said, then I was just talking to my dad. I always call him after your show and share some of the pearls of wisdom.
Terrific.
And we said, well, why don't, does that apply to like brokerage accounts and things like that? Can I go add my dad said, well, why don't you add me as a joint owner to all your accounts? And when I kick the bucket in a couple of years, you won't have to pay, we'll rebasis those things. And
Yeah.
I figure if that was a thing, that everybody would be doing it.
Yeah. I know that spousal accounts get a step up in basis in Texas for 100%. So if you were married and your spouse predeceased you and you had a $250,000 cost basis in a brokerage account with a $500,000 market value at the date of your spouse's demise, your basis would be stepped up to that amount.
Okay.
So now, on non-spousal, I don't know. Yeah, I don't know that. And maybe that's a great question. And if we moved into Stump the Chump period here, because I don't want to tell you that if you put your dad on, he's older than you are, he predeceases, you get a step up, because I agree with you. If that were the case, you would think everybody would do it. And so maybe
well,
we'll
I hope I got it in early enough where some people can call in.
Yes.
And if it really takes marrying my dad, I think that's legal in California, but that might be the only place.
Yeah, but I'm not sure. I'm guessing your dad from his generation would not take kindly to that suggestion.
You're right. Have a great one, Carl.
Okay, you too. Thanks. You're listening to Money Market Funds. You are, actually. But you're also listening to Money Talk on News Radio KLBJ. Call or text 512-836-0590. So now we come to the third bucket. The first bucket's money, living expenses. The second bucket is the money you're going to spend that you know is coming, that's of a larger amount that you wouldn't be able to take out of your checking account. And now we come to the one where it's the most interesting, has the best potential, and is the most complicated, right? And that's investing in financial assets, or for that matter, in investment real estate. And here, what is it that you're trying to accomplish? I think everybody listening to the show wants a moment, a time, a period in your life where when you get up in the morning, whatever it is you do that day, you do because you want to and not because you have to. That's what I call financial independence. Now, for some people, particularly in capital cities like Austin, Texas, where a large employer is the state, people there will have, if they work for the state, required period of time, will have what's called a defined benefit pension plan, and they will have guaranteed income. And if they've paid into Social Security, they'll have that as well. So it may be that they have financial independence and don't have to worry about investing in the financial markets. My father worked for an electric utility on the Mississippi and had a defined benefit plan. And when he retired, his Social Security income and his pension income, and the fact that he didn't have any kids at home, and that my mom and dad had no other liabilities, they were in better financial shape than they were years earlier. For those of you who are older, you'll remember the name of this vehicle. My parents went from driving Chevrolets to driving Oldsmobiles because they had more cash income after their expenses. But if you're not in that position, if you work in the private sector, the odds of you having a defined benefit pension plan are slim and none. Even companies that used to have them, local employers like, say, 3M, for example, or the large law firms, their retiring partners and their retiring employees had a defined benefit plan. But that's gone the way of the dodo bird, because it put all of the liability on the employer's back. Yes, you had to put money in, but the employer had the responsibility to invest it and to pay you a lifetime income, or pay you and your spouse lifetime income. This is what the teacher's retirement system is as well. So if you're not one of those in those categories where you have a governmental pension of some sort, retired military, county, or city employee, guess who's responsible for obtaining your financial independence? You. And so you've got to take risk to make return. If there's one thing that's true in life, that's it. And what we know is, over longer periods of time, investing in the growth of the American economy through investing in U.S. equities is a winning proposition. We also know that investing in investment real estate, not your own home, is a winning proposition. What we also have observed, certainly here in Central Texas, is that the cycles of rising prices and the cycles of falling prices for real estate are extremely long. We have a period right now where, if you read the paper, you know that we have a lot of building and commercial tall buildings in the Central Business District at the same time that a lot of the large tech companies like Meta and Google have been not occupying the buildings that they've been leasing. So those buildings are still there. They're not going to go away. And eventually, prices will fall to the point where the rent, the people will move into those. They'll move out of, say, B space into A space because prices will decline. And prices will decline until there's sufficient demand to fill in those buildings. And if the demand continues, guess what? There'll be new buildings. That's a multi-year process. When everything went south here in Texas and in Oklahoma and in New Mexico and Arizona, it was 5 to 10 years before the market found equilibrium. I see it's time for me to take a break. It's a great time for you to call or text 512-836-0590. Stick around for the next half hour of Money Talk.
You're listening to Money Talk with Carl Stewart on News Radio KLBJ, 590 AM and 99.7 FM. Enjoy the podcast on newsradioklbj.com. Now, here's Carl.
Welcome back to Money Talk. I'm Carl Stewart, and you're listening to News Radio KLBJ. We're here this afternoon till 5, another 27 minutes. And if you've been listening and thinking of calling or texting with a question, now would be an excellent time to do that. You may call or text 512-836-0590. Also, you may listen online right now at newsradioklbj.com or go there at your convenience and download podcasts of previous shows. You can also download the free app SoundCloud and get the previous broadcasts as well. And then this Thursday after the news is 6 p.m., we will rebroadcast today's show. 512-836-0590. So I got a text that I hope Brad is listening. It talks about putting a child on an older person's asset brokerage account. This text person says, Carl, putting children on accounts and deeds can make the accounts and deeds available to the children's creditors, which of course makes sense. So that's something that you certainly want to keep in mind. So now we've gone to the bucket for our future financial independence. And we ask ourselves the question, what are those asset classes in which we can invest that, based on history, will accomplish our objective to see our money growing faster than the rate of inflation on an after-tax basis? And that narrows us down to common stocks, and it narrows us down to investment real estate. For a lot of us, investment real estate may not be particularly attractive because we borrow money to take on additional debt, and yet we have to pay the mortgage and we have to pay the operating expenses, and we're not in charge of what we can charge. That is the rental income, the rental rates determined by the marketplace. The other issue we have is a lack of diversification. For listeners who were here in Texas a long time ago, you will know that if you had four rental houses in, say, Northwest, Northeast, Southwest, and Southeast Austin, you weren't diversified. And the factors that led to the crash of commercial real estate in Texas would have affected all of your properties. So you'd have to have deep pockets when either you didn't have rental income or your rental income didn't meet your operating expenses, debt service, etc. So that puts us to financial assets. And in financial assets, we have a broad menu from which to choose. In addition to the cash assets that I talked about previously, the money market funds, we can also look at stocks and bonds, and we can look to other strategies as well. And I would tell you this, I think one of the best things that's occurred for people who are trying to put money into that third bucket and grow it faster than inflation on an after-tax basis is when I got started in this area 45 years ago, it was, shall I say, opaque. It was difficult to figure things out. But that's a lot less the case. The barriers to entry to be an investor are somewhere between almost nothing and nothing. If you have the interest and the time and you want to go online, you can read all kinds of stuff. Some of it true, some of it not. But you can also go to the websites of the large custodians like Charles Schwab or Vanguard or Fidelity or many, many mutual fund companies, and you can study and you can learn. You can also take a subscription to the Wall Street Journal and read that. Devote 45 minutes a day to the Wall Street Journal. After 6 months, you're going to find that you know a heck of a lot about what's going on in the global economy. And then, whereas when I got started, it was very difficult. You almost had to go to an intermediary. If you have the time and the interest and the desire, you can be your own investment advisor. You don't have to pay somebody else. And you can go to some of those custodians I mentioned earlier. They'll be happy to take your money and invest in their mutual funds. Great. But if you don't have the time, the interest, and the desire, the good news is that the marketplace is going to drive the fees that you're going to pay. If you have a CPA and she's in a locally owned firm, you can pretty well assume that whatever she charges you to prepare your taxes, if you went out and looked at two or three or four other similarly situated CPAs and showed them your tax return needs, that the fees would be very, very similar. It's the same way. Whether you end up going with an advisor with a large firm like Morgan Stanley, UBS, Merrill Lynch, Wells Fargo, et cetera, or you go to a person who owns her own business, the fees are driven by the marketplace, and they've become transparent. That was not the case in many situations when I started doing this in 1978. So there's a lot more transparency, and the fees have dropped sharply, and that's all good because if you have the time, then you're in great shape. And if you don't, if you hire a person, the marketplace has driven those fees down and costs down, both for the underlying mutual funds and exchange-traded funds, but also for the cost of advice. So if you're going to invest in the financial markets, by the way, the number to call, I'm really on a roll here, but I'd love to talk to you or answer your question, 512-836-0590. So you have a choice to make, and that is, the first one is asset allocation. What does that mean? How much of my capital, whether it's in my 401k or in my own brokerage account, how much of my capital am I going to put at risk in the stock market? And how much of it am I going to put in other assets? The benefit of putting it all in the stock market is if you have a long enough time horizon, based on history, no guarantees, the odds are extremely high that you will have a return that exceeds the rate of inflation and taxes. Now, having said that, you can go through some really tough times because the stock market cycles, unlike the real estate cycles, are much quicker. The good news is that they don't last as long. So a perfect example was in 2021, the NASDAQ, which is where a lot of the high-tech and growth companies are, in 2021, it had a return of over 22%. Think of that. And you could simply have owned, for example, and I'm not making a recommendation, the Fidelity ONEQ, which is an exchange-traded fund that tracks the NASDAQ. You were up 22.1%. Then the next year, guess what? You were down 32.1%. And the next year, last year, you were up 45.7%. And this year, you're pretty well flat after a bad week last week. You're up about 1.7%. So that's a roller coaster. And you have to look yourself in the mirror and say, do I have the fortitude? Do I have the stomach for that? Because what I've observed is something called recency bias. And that is when we've had a bad experience in the recent past and good experiences in the more distant past, we tend to remember the bad experiences more recently. Secondly, there's a whole area of study. Two men, Dan Kahneman, who recently passed away, and Richard Thaler, both received Nobel Prize for their work in proving something up called behavior finance. And it states that if you have and I have a 10% return in our 401k, it feels like a 10% return. But if we have a 20%, I beg your pardon, if we have a 10% decline, we experience it as a 20% decline. We are risk averse. Maybe one reason why we're still here on the planet is we're risk averse, but it doesn't work when it comes to investing. So the first thing you have to decide is, do I have the fortitude? Do I have the stomach for that kind of volatility? A lot of people don't. In fact, my life experience is most people don't. And in fact, there's risk associated with that. Because if you look at, say, the teacher's retirement system or the employee's retirement system or any large institutional amount of money, do they have everything in one asset class? The answer is they don't, for the very reasons I'm talking about. But on the other hand, do they have everything in bonds? The answer is no, because they can't meet their objectives of paying out to the retired teachers or to the retired state employees. So they have a mix. So that's where we get so-called diversification. It's a little bit like having rental properties in Texas and California, New Jersey, and Oregon, where the markets don't all go up and down at the same time or in the same amount. So that's your job, or it's your advisor's job. And what we do know from experience, I know this personally from my experience, and I know this from reading about the history, is that's the most important decision, because that's going to drive your return. So if you were all in on the NASDAQ, you had a really bumpy ride. On the other hand, if you had other assets, as things went down, you didn't go down as much, and you have to be prepared to pay the price, which is when things went up, you don't go up as much. But you can craft, or your advisor can craft, a really thoughtful and even sophisticated portfolio of financial assets. So the question is, Carl, should I buy individual stocks? And the answer, of course, is it depends. So my experience is this. Two things can go wrong with individual stocks, and one thing can go right. The one thing that can go right is if you're in the right stock at the right time, you can make a heck of a lot of money. People who invested in NVIDIA, which happens to be a local employer, 3, 4, 5 years ago, have had spectacular returns. But the benefit of being around so long and the benefit of having money talk on for so long, I remember vividly back in the 90s, particularly 95 through 1999, when Dell Computer was really transforming Central Texas. And there was a period of time when, if you look backwards over 10 years, it was the best performing stock in the S&P 500. I've got a text coming in, so I'll put that on hold, because what I'm talking about, I would say, are evergreen topics. They're always important. Okay, let's just see what we've got here. Carl, love the show. Great as always. Thank you. I would like to deposit a lump sum into an account for each of my two boys that would grow to $1 million or more by the time they retire at 62. They are age 18 and 21. How much would I need to deposit for each of them? What kind of account? IRA, Roth, mutual fund, etc. So you first start by deciding what you think a reasonable rate of return is. So if you chose 6%, then it would take, you put 6 into 72. That's called the rule of 72. And the answer is 12. The money would double in 12 years. So you figure out how many years do you have to go until they're age 62. So let's suppose, because we can divide it by 12, let's suppose it's 36 years. So if you put $250,000 in 12 years is $500,000. Okay, let's even less. And in 24 years, it's $1 million. That's the beauty of compounding. You determine what you think is a reasonable return, and you divide that into 72, and that will tell you how many years it takes to double. You get close to that age, 62, and then you can just compound at 6% or whatever number you use. Now, you have to be careful. I remember back in the great bull market of the 90s, it was very common for people to think, I'm going to assume a 10% return, because after all, we'd had 5 consecutive years of where the S&P 500 had returned more than 20%, so 10 seemed perfectly reasonable. Then the dot-com bust occurred, the NASDAQ went down, and didn't recover for 15 years. So I would argue on the side of a more conservative return, like 6%. I hope we get more, that would be great, but I think that's a more conservative number. That would tell you what the math needs to be. And then what kind of account? Well, you're not going to be able to use an IRA or a Roth, I think, because you're going to have to put more money in than the maximum contribution for both of those. And so you were going to open an individual account for them, and they're both old enough at 18 and 21 that you can have that they can open an account in their name and you can make the deposit. So then you have the asset allocation decision. If you have the fortitude, the stomach for the volatility of the stock market, that will give you the best return and will cause you to have the least amount of money to put in. And so then the thing is, you want a, what we call a taxable, or some people call a brokerage account, where you put the money in and you reinvest the dividends and capital gains. I see it's 48 minutes after the hour, so I'm going to take a break and come back and do my best to answer your question. Call me at 512-836-0590. I'll be back.
You're listening to Money Talk with Carl Stewart on News Radio KLBJ, 590 AM and 99.7 FM. Enjoy the podcast on newsradioklbj.com. Now, here's Carl.
Welcome back to Money Talk. I'm Carl Stewart, and you're listening to News Radio KLBJ. Thanks for listening. If you have a question, call or text 512-836-0590. I did the math in my head, and if you had, I think I'm right, if you had 36 years and you were, and to do it, because I can divide that by 12, and if you started with $125,000, at the end of 12 years, it'd be $250,000, at the end of 24 years, it'd be $500,000, and at the end of 36 years, it'd be $1 million. Remarkable, but that's at a 6% compound return. So if I were going, I know this is hypothetical, but if I were going to do that, and I was willing to live with the volatility of the stock market, then I would open that brokerage account, each child would, and I would invest in stock funds. If you want to do it simply, just invest in an index fund, probably an exchange-traded fund. It'll throw off no capital gains based on history and very little in the way of dividends, which are reinvested to compound the growth. I would not invest in individual stocks. Now, if that volatility is something that really is unacceptable, then you start adding other strategies, and you have to think about possibly reducing two things: reducing the risk, the downside risk, and reducing the return. Now, I did get a text, and I'm going to read it right now because I saw it come in during the commercial, and it said, in the scenario you just played out, wouldn't he have to pay gift taxes on a lump sum contribution to start this $1 million process? I thought there were caps of around $18,000 per year that you can give extended family members without paying gift taxes. Well, there's also called the unified exemption, which is now, I think, over close to $12 million. So unless this person were extremely wealthy, he could put whatever amount, or she could, whatever amount into the account, reduce their exemption by that amount, and then upon their demise, their estate that would not be subject to taxation would be lowered. So let's suppose that they put in $250,000. Okay. Right now, the exemption is, like I said, it's close to $12 million. And when they died, if their estate was $5 million or $6 million or $10 million, there wouldn't be any estate tax, as the rules are right now. So they're not limited to the gift. Also, they can give that $18,000, that's also, and not reduce their exemption. And they can give it, frankly, to anybody they want to. Give it to Carl Stewart. I'd like that. So they can do that under the $18,000 restriction, or they can simply reduce their exemption to do that. You're listening to Money Talk on News Radio KLBJ. Call or text 512-836-0590. Here's a text. Carl, what can Joe do to lower inflation? If Joe could do it, he'd already have done it. So, nothing he can do about it. He's trying to, you know, there aren't a lot of levers. What we know is that in good times, the president's going to take credit, and in bad times, the voters are going to give him credit or her credit, but it's been him so far. So, you know, the Federal Reserve's got a lot more to say about inflation, and what the Federal Reserve is saying is, wait a minute, this economy is stronger than we ever anticipated it would be when we raised rates from almost zero to 5 to 5.25%. The theory is that ought to reduce business activity because businesses borrow money to invest and to run their businesses. And businesses are going to reduce their activity. And as a consequence of that, they're going to not need as many employees. They're going to let people go, have layoffs, and the economy is going to soften, perhaps go into a recession. Then, because there's less demand in the economy, and roughly two-thirds of the gross domestic product of the United States is consumption rather than producing goods, it's things we buy from services to a great extent. And when we have reduced demand, then what happens to prices? Prices roll over and you reduce inflation. Paul Volcker did that after years and years of inflation by running interest rates up to over 18%. I think they were even higher than that, and threw the economy into a deep recession. In fact, in 1982, the Wall Street Journal said, is this a recession or a depression? So that's the Fed playbook. But what's happening through a combination of productivity increases in immigration is that the economy is going along at 3.8% unemployment, and that what they call the last mile, getting inflation down from 3 plus to 2, is going to be a real hard thing to do. And that's why people are beginning to wonder if it would be possible that we're going to keep rates higher for a longer period of time. Better not call, because, but you can text 512-836-0590. Here is a text. Caller to produce $1 million account. Just remind them that the value are not buying power. Taxes will be due. Yeah, that's true. That's not buying power. But if he left it in cash, it'd be even worse. And if it's $1 million, they'll be subject to the long-term capital gains tax rate. And if they don't take it out all at the same time and they're retired, that tax rate can be very attractive. So there's no question that we aren't taking into account taxes. But if they were just put it in, you know, an exchange-traded fund that followed the total stock market and it threw off no tax liabilities other than the dividends, it would seem to me that would be very attractive. You're listening to Money Talk. I'm just going to bloviate for a couple of more minutes on the bucket theory that I've been talking about this afternoon. So the first thing you decide for that third bucket is, what's the right mix for me? Whether that's investment, real estate, stocks, bonds, or commodities, currencies, all other kinds of things. And again, do it yourself or engage an advisor. That's going to determine your future value. And that's where the real rub lies, if you will. And I've got this chart I got this week, and it just shows you how you can't predict the future. This is the most profitable asset class over the last 20 years per calendar year that you could invest in. Okay, it starts in 2005. And just listen to this. I'm going to go each year, starting in 2005. Stocks, then metals, then energies, metals, bonds, interest rates, stocks, bonds. That got you to 2014. Starting in 2015, energies, bonds, stocks, interest rates, bonds, currencies, energy, bonds, interest rates, and year-to-date stocks. Now, there's no possible way that you would know in advance which asset class to invest in. So the question is, do I invest in these? And the answer should be yes. How do I do that on my own or with somebody? In funds, exchange-traded funds, and usual 40 Act funds that give me exposure to the various asset classes. And finally, how do they respond and how do they behave in relation to one another? That's called correlation. Does it always work? Not for stocks and bonds in 2022, but generally you'll see bonds have low correlation, investment-grade bonds to stocks, but nothing works all the time, and there are other asset classes as well. Well, I hope you've enjoyed the show today. I think I've been talking for the better part of an hour, so I want to thank Kyle for doing his usual good job and to invite you next Saturday after the news at 4 to join me on Money Talk.
Carl Stewart is an investment advisor representative of Carl Stewart Investment Advisor Incorporated.